Shall we? Thanks. All right, good. So I've just kind of prepared an assortment of topics that we can kind of give you a flavor of the kinds of things people wonder about in quantum information. Okay, so I wanted to start by talking a bit about complexity. Complexity classes. So loosely speaking, the idea is to understand how hard it is to solve certain problems. So the kind of one of the kind of major questions is to distinguish whether problems can be solved using polynomial or exponential resources. A major question is to determine if some problem requires resources that grow polynomially versus exponentially in the problem size. So an example, which we'll come back to, is finding the prime factors of a large number. Of an n bit number. So here, what's the problem size? It's the number of bits you need to write down the number. So here, the problem size is the number of bits needed to specify the input. The input being the number you want to factor. And then the resources are basically how many computational bits do you need as a function of the number of bits n that fixes the problem size, and how many time steps or computational steps do you need to find the solution. So the resources include the kind of spatial requirements, which basically means the size of the computational register. Needed to solve the problem, and the time requirement, which is how many steps in the computation, how many operations are required to find the solution. Now, people talk about the computational complexity can be, there's a subtlety here where you distinguish between the operations in parallel versus not in parallel. So if I have, you know, n classical bits and I have to do n operations to solve the problem, then the complexity is n, which is linear in the problem size. But the depth of the circuit, so the amount of time it takes to execute the circuit, can be much shorter than n. So for example, if I can do all the operations in parallel, then if I'm doing n operations in parallel, the complexity is n operations, but the depth is 1, because it's just a single time step, problem solved, just as a trivial example. So the point is the number of operations and the time can be unrelated because of parallelization. Okay, so in computing science, there's this, Scott Aronson calls it the complexity zoo. So there's this enormous number of distinctions you can make on characterizing the complexity it takes to solve a problem. We're just going to look at two or three important categories of problems. So here we have the complexity class P. There's a way to define these objects that's very formal, which I'm not going to use. I'm just going to give you a more intuitive description of the complexity classes. So the complexity class P is the class of problems that can be solved in polynomial time and polynomial space. So in other words, the number of operations goes as order n to the k for some k. So here, the complexity is a polynomial in the input size, n. By a Turing machine. Okay, so what's a Turing machine? So a Turing machine is basically an archetype classical computer. So Turing imagined the idea of a computer before we actually had them, and he just imagined you had some very long piece of magnetic tape, and each slot in the tape you could magnetically encode a 0 or a 1. In two different magnetic states at that location on the tape. And then you had a head which could read and write the tape. So it can read whether it's 0 or 1, and it can change that if it wants, or it can move down the tape and change some other location. So it's this very kind of simple mechanical model of a computation, an abstract model of computation, which is a standard model, a paradigm of classical computation. I should mention, so a Turing machine is an archetype or just a paradigmatic model of computation. It doesn't really matter what it is because of something called the strong Church-Turing thesis. So the strong Church-Turing thesis, which we now believe to be false because of quantum computers. But so the strong Church-Turing thesis is that any other model of computation for solving a problem, if a Turing machine can solve a problem in polynomial time, whatever the complexity of solving the problem on the Turing machine is, any other model of a computer would have only polynomial overhead relative to it. So basically what it's saying is, with respect to this distinction between exponential and polynomial, all computers are the same. So you can't have one model of computer that would solve the problem in exponential time, and then you change the model and the problem becomes solvable in polynomial time. So it's a thesis, it's a hypothesis that all models of computation are polynomially equivalent. So the way to say this formally is that any model of computation can be simulated by a Turing machine, can be simulated on a possibly probabilistic Turing machine with at most a polynomial increase in the number of operations. Okay, so let me just remark that if quantum computers offer an exponential speed up, then this is false. So just, yeah? We hope this is false.
So what is the actual requirement for something to be called computation for this?
Geez, that's a good question. I've never thought of that. A model of computation, I kind of take it to be intuitive. I don't really know.
Well, like, if I said I want to do some computation, but one of the steps I'm allowed to do is find prime factorizations, then the Turing machine could not polynomially simulate that. Right?
Yeah, I see what you mean. So just
if you put in a factoring oracle.
Yeah, no. So the question is basically, We can trivially prove this false by creating a computer, one of whose elementary operations is just, you know, the entire factoring algorithm. Uh-huh. Take that as an element. Okay.
I probably. But the point is, what other machines can a Turing machine
simulate?
So. No, his point is this. I mean, suppose we have a problem. Suppose we have an algorithm which takes exponential, which is exponentially hard on a Turing machine. So the number of elementary Turing operations is exponential in the problem size. Now define another computer who has define its elementary operation as the operation that factors a number of size 10 to the 10 in a single step. Then clearly this is false. So there must be some reasonable way to constrain the model. Probably some requirement of universality or something like that. But yeah, it's a good question. I should know the answer, but I don't. I'm sure there's some way to define the model of computation to avoid that. OK, so then there's the complexity class. And I've added the word probabilistic here because it turns out that if you add randomness as a resource to your classical computer, so your computer has the ability to flip a coin, then that actually buys you an advantage for some problems. So that's why we allow the Turing machine to have access to a, we consider that to be a relatively free resource, randomness. And when you're actually comparing quantum mechanics with classical computing, you actually, it's natural to allow the classical computer to have randomness. So we generalize the model to a probabilistic model. So next I want to tell you about the complexity class NP. So the complexity class NP is defined in a bit of an unusual way. It's the set of problems where you can verify a candidate solution in polynomial time. So loosely speaking, there's a way to define this formally. for which the solution, for which a candidate solution can be verified in polynomial time and I should say, but for which finding the solution may take exponential time. Finding a solution may take either exponential or polynomial time. Let me move that up for you. So what's an example of a problem that would be in this class, that's believed to be in this, well, that's definitely in this class?
Satisfiability.
Okay, maybe. I don't remember. But another example is, I should be careful when I ask questions like that. A prime example is factoring. Oh, it's NP complete, right? So the notion of completeness is a problem for which any other problem in that class can be reduced to that problem, right? So it's, if you can show that an NP complete problem has some property, then it's true of all property problems in that class. So the example I wanted to bring up, satisfiability sounds like a good one. Sounds very plausible that you know what you're talking about. Factoring. So think about factoring. So if you have a very long bit string corresponding to some large number, finding the prime factors, not obvious how to do it. But if I give you two factors and say, hey, these two prime numbers are factors of that big number, well, it's easy, you just multiply them together and check if you get the big number back. So it's very easy to check if two prime numbers multiply together to give the larger number. But there's an asymmetry in the problem where, given the large number, finding the prime factors can be very hard. So now, in the case of factoring, is known to be in NP, but it is not known whether it's also in P. So what we have is a situation where we have the set NP, and then inside it we have P. And it's an open question in computing science whether or not NP is equal to P. So no one's been able to prove a problem that there exists a problem which is NP but that is not in P. Is that clear? So a major open question is P equal to NP. So that basically NP is just trivial. I mean, that there's no need to even make the distinction. So that any problem whose solution can be verified in polynomial time can also be solved in polynomial time. That's the question, and it's widely believed to be false. So it's generally accepted or widely believed that P is not equal to NP. So that there are problems which have this asymmetry, that it's easy to check a solution but hard to find a solution.
If P was equal to NP, then would you
need to modify the definition of NP that you put there, where the solution may be exponential?
Well, I just said it may either be, yeah, so then you would, well, this is still strictly true, but we can make a stronger statement. But we wouldn't even need to make a stronger statement because we could just stop talking about NP.
I assume this is a question that cannot be answered quickly, but...
in polynomial time?
So I can see how, given an algorithm to solve a problem, you would go about determining whether it was polynomial or exponential or whatever. But in general, how do you think about a problem in the abstract? To prove that you could not find an algorithm in some class of type.
Yeah, so I've never looked at proofs of this type, but they're generally hard, and also there are very few such proofs. Okay. So in general, proving anything about inclusions and proving that some problem is within a certain complexity is very hard. But there are a few instances. I guess we heard about SAT is provably NP-complete, which means that if you could prove that satisfiability had a polynomial solution, then that means any other problem in NP would also have a polynomial solution, things like that, right? So, we're just touching on this incredible hierarchy of complexity classes. But for quantum computing, the motivation for quantum computing is really, we see right here the problem, which is that, now it turns out that so factoring is known to be an NP because we can verify the solution in polynomial time, but it is not known whether we can find a solution in polynomial time. That's an open problem for factoring. It's also, of course, if you could prove this, then you would solve this problem as well. But there's other routes to solving this problem, this P equals NP question, than factoring. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused because we know that all problems that are solvable in polynomial time are also checkable in polynomial time. That's right.
Yes.
And so didn't we say that, aren't you saying, I thought you said that all problems which are NP are like an equivalency class, so that, no, that's not true.
Not all problems. There are special candidate problems which are shown to be complete in the sense that if you could solve that problem, you can solve any other problem in the class. But not all problems in that class have that property. Factoring is not one of those. So I don't actually, it's conjecture. No one knows if it is, but it's never been proven that it is. Okay, so then the next thing I want to tell you about is the class BPP. This is bounded error probabilistic time, which again, I'm giving kind of loose definitions here. This is, and I'll write it loosely, the set of problems that can be solved in polynomial time given access to randomness. Yeah.
The possibility of quantum computing adjust this at all with this line computer.
It is a classic question. Yeah. The question, if something belongs to pure NP based on criteria for solving them with classical computing.
Classical computing. Okay. But if you allow for quantum computing, does that?
Well, quantum computing breaks the strong Church-Turing thesis. Our physical model of computation is no longer universal in the sense that it can actually cross this exponential polynomial boundary. So generally speaking, BPP is considered the classical analog of BQP, which is the class of problems that can be solved in polynomial time on a quantum computer.
And that's also probabilistically?
Yes. So, I mean, the idea is you define a notion of a constant success probability, and you can push that success probability to be arbitrarily close to 1. With only polynomial overhead, you can make your probability of success go to 1 very rapidly. So you can essentially just assume it's a uniform success. But you allow randomness classically, and quantumly we intrinsically get randomness from the uncertainty principle. So if the quantum state has a superposition in the computational basis, which we'll define in a moment, then you have a probability of getting each outcome based on the squared amplitude. So the point is you might have to run the computer a few times to estimate a probability, and then from that you get your answer. And so it's the same thing in the classical probabilistic model. So you have randomness. Basically, you want to sample a solution space, for example. So now the point is, thanks to Shor's algorithm, from Shor's factoring algorithm, which I'm sure you've all heard about, we know that factoring is in BQP. So who wants to factor large numbers? The NSA, for example. So the scheme that underlies most encryption standards, for example, what you use on the internet when you pay with your credit card, you want to encrypt your credit card information in a way where you haven't prearranged anything with the company. So you need some scheme to be able to share information privately without having previously communicated and established some shared randomness, for example. So it's easy to, if we have a one-time pad, it's an easy way to encrypt. So, you know, you and I meet up beforehand, we decide on a very long string of random numbers, we each keep a copy in our back pocket. If I want to send you a message, I translate that message into a bit string, I do a pairwise addition of that bit string with this random key, I send that over a public channel, which any of you can observe, but for you guys, it looks like a random bit string. Because if you take a fixed message and add a random bit string, you get another random bit string out. But the recipient of the message who shares the random key with me can then just bitwise add the random key to the encrypted message and get the plain text message out. So that's an easy way to have what's called information theoretic security, but it's impractical because you can't have pre-established random keys with everybody you might want to talk with or communicate with. So the solution, the practical solution that's used in most public key cryptography schemes is based on the asymmetry of the factoring problem. So it's based on the fact that I can broadcast to the person I want to communicate with a very large number, and they can use that very large number to encrypt the message in a way that the only way anybody can decrypt that message is if they know the prime factors. So you exploit the asymmetry of the factoring problem to get secure encryption. So then you send me the message encrypted by this very large number. Nobody knows the prime factors except for me because I picked a huge number. And then I can decrypt the message using the prime factors, and nobody else can. So that way, without having established a prior relationship at all, we can communicate privately. The security of that scheme rests on the assumption that NP is not equal to P, and that factoring is in NP. So those are two separate assumptions. So if that's true, then we have secure, well, we thought we had secure means of encryption against an adversary that has insufficient computational power. So clearly, by brute force, I can search every single possible set of integers and see which ones are prime factors of this very large number. But the idea is that that can take a very long time. And so if you make another assumption, which is the bound, you put a bound on the computational power of your adversary, then you have security. So there's three assumptions, right? We're assuming P is not equal to NP. We're assuming that factoring is indeed an NP. And we're assuming that the adversary doesn't have ridiculous computational resources. So clearly one of those assumptions is false based on, you know, what we've just learned this past year from Snowden. Okay, so a lot of people believe that that's the case. I mean, generally speaking, you know, the military apparatus has enormous resources, and they might even know that factoring is in P and haven't told anybody. Although, according to Snowden, most of the techniques they use is based on the fact that implementations of the encryption scheme are poor. There are weaknesses in the implementation or explicit factor. Anyways, we're not going to go into the details of that. But the point is, this is a very important problem for the very, you know, assumption of private communication, which is important to everyone. Yes?
What about, I think it's called a handshake, called a super handshake algorithm or something, whereby I encrypt my bit string with a random key, send it to you, then you encrypt it with your own key, send it back to me, I encrypt my part, send it back to you, you encrypt your part. So in that way, it's never unencrypted, and you don't need to give information to each other.
Yeah, that sounds like something that I've thought about before, but I don't remember why that's not viable. I mean, that sounds very simple to implement. So it sounds like if that's correct, then that would be an adequate solution. But yeah, I don't understand how. Yeah, I guess I don't understand how that would work. Because at some point, you've got to know how to decrypt. Yeah, okay, so I don't know. I guess I don't know. I don't know why that isn't a viable alternative, but I assume it's not. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in this predicament. So anyway, so now to turn our story back to the motivation for quantum information, because of Shor's algorithm, if you can build a quantum computer, a fault-tolerant quantum computer, then that breaks the security scheme. So, you know, there's enormous interest in whether a quantum computer can be built because of the fact that Shor's algorithm is provably puts factoring in BQP, and therefore, now then the only challenge is the technical challenge of building a quantum computer. Okay. So, so basically, a quantum computer offers people typically say a quantum computer gives an exponential speed up for certain problems, but we have to be careful because we don't know for sure that we don't know for sure that we don't know for sure whether factoring is classically outside of P, but if we assume that factoring is outside of P, then quantum computers give an exponential speed up. And there are certain what are called oracle problems where a quantum computer is provably exponentially stronger than a classical computer, but for real world problems, that exponential speed up rests on the assumption that there are in fact exponentially hard problems classically, problems that are in NP. Okay, so that's the kind of the paradigm for that. And then I should mention also the so here's the first motivation for quantum computing. The second motivation for quantum computing is quantum simulation. So this is what Feynman first realized in like 1980 or something like that, that if you had a universal quantum computer, you could use it to solve interesting problems about quantum mechanics. So quantum simulation is the other major motivation. So typically, if I have some many-body system, a condensed matter system, or maybe a complicated molecule I'm interested in studying from a biochemical point of view, then typically, if that system has, so consider a quantum system comprised of n d-dimensional subsystems, particles. The Hilbert space is equal to C, we'll call it C to the capital D, where D is equal to D to the N. So the Hilbert space of my full quantum system grows exponentially with the number of subsystems. So think of the subsystem as, you know, a bunch of particles on a lattice that interact. So if I have n sites on the lattice and each site has d dimensions, then I have this exponentially large Hilbert space. So that means that my unitary transformation is a linear operator on this huge space. And if I wanted to classically simulate this, then I very quickly realize that as n gets big, I don't even have the RAM capacity in the memory of my computer to store all of the information I need to simulate this system. So the idea is that classical simulation, the number of classical bits grows exponentially so the amount of just the space required to solve this problem grows exponentially with n, the number of subsystems. So this means this is why it's hard to just, you know, throw a complicated many-body problem onto a classical computer and discover everything you want to know about it. Because it's an exponential. So in practice, people can, like, if you think about systems of qubits or two-level systems, like if you have a lattice of spin half particles and you want, and they're all interacting and you want to explore how the dynamics occur for that n set of spin half particles, then for, you know, modern day computers, you can typically go up to n equals 20 or 25. So you can have 20 or 25 spin half systems. But if you have 100 spin half systems, it's just not feasible to classically compute what's happening in that physical quantum system. Yeah?
The dimension d, if that's the tensor product of n d-dimensional or little d-dimensional systems, so should that be nd? No? Right, but it's
C to the D tensor, C to the D.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
N times.
Alright, gotcha.
Okay. So the idea is then a quantum computer only requires a number of qubits that grows linearly with the number of subsystems. Right, because my quantum system, my Hilbert space dimension, it's going to be like, you know, log d or something is the proportionality constant. Log base 2 of d. Now, this is a little bit of a cheat because what you get when you do a quantum simulation with a quantum computer is not exactly what you get if you do a classical simulation. So the classical simulation goes exponentially in n, but I do that simulation, I get all of the information about the quantum state. So I have my physical quantum system that I want to simulate, so it's some, you know, protein or some condensed matter system or some array, some lattice of spin half particles. The physical quantum system, my wave function goes from I equals 1 to D, C I. So a classical simulation, which is exponentially hard, gives me maybe up to some, you know, digits of precision, up to some fixed precision, it gives me all of these coefficients. So it gives me d complex numbers. It's an exponentially hard thing to do, but I get all of these complex numbers out. Is that clear? But if I do a quantum simulation on a quantum computer, I only need a linear number of qubits. And one hopes that the time of the computation is also just polynomial in the actual physical process time. But the trick is, when you do the quantum computer simulation, you don't get all this information, right? So if you think about quantum, okay, here I am again with this same theme, but this is, people surprisingly just get confused about this. But look, if I do a quantum simulation, if I do one run of my quantum computer, what do I get out when I do a measurement at the end? I get a single sample from the probability distribution, a quantum simulation gives me a random sample from the probability distribution P equal to C1 squared, C2 squared, CD squared. Right? If I make a measurement, Born's rule says that I get an outcome, which is going to be an n-bit string. And I get that n-bit string with a probability. And the probability that I get that n-bit string is given by the square of the amplitude. So even though the quantum simulation is exponentially more compact than the classical one, I get exponentially less information out. So if you want to get an advantage with a quantum computer for simulation, you better be sure that the information you want to get, that the probability distribution somehow has some useful information in it that can be obtained via just sampling a few times. So for example, if there is a periodicity in the probability amplitudes, I can detect that quickly. If the probability is concentrated on one outcome, then I can find that out very, very easily with very few samples of the quantum computer. But if you're not promised that there's some interesting structure in the output, then you have no promise that the quantum simulation is going to be of any use, because you might have to repeat the quantum simulation an exponential number of times in order to estimate these probabilities well enough to learn what you wanted to know about the system you were simulating. So that's a subtlety which is surprisingly not appreciated universally. Yeah. Yeah, but that's a resource. So if you're telling me I have a million copies of the quantum computer and I can solve the problem by just running each of those once, well, that's kind of, I'm comparing apples and oranges. I'm comparing a million quantum computers to one classical computer. That's not really fair. I'll flog the dead horse here. But look, the point is, it's obvious that you have this problem if you think about quantum states as states of incomplete knowledge. It's when you start thinking about quantum states as physical objects, you start thinking that these coefficients are physical properties of my quantum state, therefore they're somehow immediately accessible. But they're not accessible because they're informational properties, they're not physical properties. So people just naively don't recognize this distinction, and again, I think it's because of just a naive understanding of quantum mechanics conceptually. Yeah.
Don't understand that distinction. If you thought of this, your state, as being an actual physical
thing. Still, when you do your measurement at the end, you only get out one of the eigenstates, right?
That's right.
So why can't you think of it as a physical state?
The point is the physical thing is the bit string you get out, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. That's the outcome. That's the k. Remember our Born rule, the probability of outcome k is equal to the trace of rho against the projector onto the eigenstate k, right? So what's physical is k, with the pointer position. But these coefficients, ci, which are complex numbers, you don't get those out at the end of the computation.
Right.
You have to estimate them by repeating the experiment a sufficient number of times that you get an estimate of this probability. And in fact, you don't get the phase factor either. You just get the amplitude squared, right? So the point is, but if I do a classical simulation, sure, there's an exponential overhead in the size of the computer relative to the size of the system I'm simulating. But when I do that one calculation, I get all d of these complex numbers up to some fixed precision on one run. Because these are encoded, each of these is encoded in some bit string, which represents the finite precision of that complex number. So I mean, this is an important conceptual distinction. So what's needed for, I mean, the hard part of showing that quantum simulation buys you an exponential advantage is figuring out ways to make sure that the information you're trying to find out about is somehow accessible through efficient sampling schemes. And so Shor's algorithm does that. So Shor's algorithm, you end up sampling this, but then you see a periodicity in which bit strings pop up, and that tells you something about the prime factors. Emily?
If the coefficients are already information, what is it that we're trying to simulate and find out about?
Well, that's the question. So you have to decide, what is it about this complex quantum many-body system that I want to know, right?
But I mean, what is it, if the amplitudes are not features of the physical system, what are we simulating?
I mean, whether or not they're physical, they're all in a certain way, right?
You want to have the ground state of anybody coming from
it. Yeah, but
but I see what you're getting at. I'm sure there's a very good answer to that, and I'd probably just have to think for a second to come up with it. So here, discuss amongst yourselves.
the amplitudes and not just amplitude squares are interesting if you want information about what the system does in the different cases, which also says that you can get information about the amplitudes by measuring your qubits in a different phases.
But what happens if you get information about the amplitudes if the amplitudes just are information? Isn't it something that you take yourself to be finding out about?
Well, here's the thing. So consider the problem of Anderson localization. So Anderson localization is a really neat phenomena. You basically have some lattice. So you imagine some, say, cubic lattice as a simple example. And then the point is you have some inhomogeneity in the nuclei at each lattice site, so that if you have an electron moving around on this lattice, it sees random potential strengths at each lattice site. So classically, that problem would correspond to you drop an electron on the lattice, it would diffuse with the typical diffusion constant. Just if it's an infinite lattice, it will just diffuse infinitely. So your probability distribution classically of where you find the electron would just keep growing, in the usual way. Random processes grow. It's like square root of the width of the probability distribution grows as the square root of the number of time steps, something like that. There's a quantum phenomena discovered by Anderson called Anderson localization, for which he won the Nobel Prize. And that's that in the quantum setting, if I drop an electron on this lattice and treat the problem quantum mechanically, what happens is it diffuses classically until it reaches some length scale at which it just stops diffusing. So the probability distribution of the electron stays localized essentially about the point where it started. And if you just let time evolve, it just stays there. It won't go further away. But classically, it would just keep diffusing. So this is a true quantum phenomena with no classical analog. And that would be a problem. You'd say, well, I want to find out what's the localization length for this lattice. So if I do it on a quantum computer, I would find that I would get a probability distribution over lattice sites over site I, and after for some time greater than the localization time scale, what I'll find is that the distribution is localized with some width called the localization length over lattice sites. I'm treating it as one-dimensional here, but it would be like a two-dimensional probability distribution, say, for a two-dimensional lattice. But classically, this distribution would increase without bound as t increases, and this would be true. So for all t greater than the localization time scale, you get this localization length. So if I did this on a quantum computer, and I evolved for a time greater than t localization, now I can sample this probability distribution, which is information. And what I'd get, I'd be able to estimate the width of that probability distribution with very few samples, is the idea. But classically, I'd have to do an exponentially hard computation to figure out what this localization length is. So I agree that while this isn't an, kind of an airtight illustration of how the information corresponds to the physics, it's an example of how sampling can be done in a way that you get useful information about a physical property of the system from the probability distribution of where the electron might be. So the information here is where is how localizes the electron's wave function. The Bohmian potential is the answer. You know, I don't think there's a good answer to that question. I don't think people really know how to answer that question.
So do you think there is no answer, or we just don't know what the answer is?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on this topic. I mean, I just know a little bit about it. But I think that once we understand quantum mechanics, we will have a good answer to that question. Okay, good. So now I've kind of given you the cheerleading story for why we want a quantum computer. So now let me tell you a little bit about the mechanics of what a quantum computer is. Go ahead.
So you just say basically that a quantum simulation would be a Monte Carlo simulation of a quantum computer.
In some sense, yeah.
So we never have a true, accurate answer, only to a certain degree of order. Would it follow the same sort of rules that Monte Carlo simulations have for accuracy in terms of your error?
Well, I mean, like I mentioned, I mean, the correct analog for BQP is a polynomial BPP, which includes, this allows for like Monte Carlo simulations would be in BPP, because you're using randomness to sample and so on. But it's just an important caveat to people to realize that if you want to show that you have some algorithm that's exponentially faster for quantum simulation, you have to show not only that the number of qubits you need is polynomial in the number of physical systems n, you have to show that the length of the algorithm is polynomial in n, the number of d-dimensional systems, and the part that people usually forget is you have to show that there's some way to sample the information you want from the output, because you don't get to read out these complex coefficients, you just get to sample from their amplitudes. Yeah.
Are you saying that BQP and BPP are the same?
No. So BPP is a property of probabilistic Turing machines.
Are there problems that lie in one but not the other?
Well, Shor's algorithm is believed to be in BQP but not in BPP. Yeah, so they're logically distinct. Whether they're in fact equivalent is an open theoretical question. All right, we're good? So let's look at some of the mechanics of how this works. So we'll just look at the circuit model of quantum computing. Was there a question there? So basically, you have a system of n qubits. Where each qubit, a qubit is a two-level system. So my full initial state we write as 0 tensor n. And so the full Hilbert space, the quantum computer, I guess the state the state of the quantum computer is an element of C 2 to the n. And then we break down the computation into a series of gates. So we'll call this gate U1. And then we'll do another gate U2. And then we can do another gate . So here the idea is this is a gate acting between the first qubit and the last qubit, so it doesn't affect. We'll call this U3. And then you might have, you know, U4 and so on. So the idea is that a unitary U acting on LC 2 to the n is decomposed into a circuit of elementary operations, each of which acts on, say, one or two qubits at a time. There are some gates, the Toffoli gate, which acts on 3 qubits. So the fact that I'm saying it acts on 2 qubits is just the typical case. You can pick any subdivision you want. Into a circuit of elementary operations, U sub I, each of which belongs to U4. Would any of you like a reminder what U4 means? OK, so basically, in general, we have UD. It corresponds to the set, and it's actually a group of unitary operations acting on CD. So here U4. UI is an element of the set of unitary operations acting on 2 qubits, or a 4-dimensional Hilbert space. So our overall circuit consisting of the full unitary, that's a unitary in, I can also write this as U in UD, U2 to the n. This is, i.e., this is another way to write this. So, of course, the set of linear operators on C2 to the n is a very big set. And here we're considering U as, in particular, it's a unitary operator, which is an element of the unitary group on 2 to the n. So the idea is we decompose our general unitary into a sequence of unitaries acting on a small subset of qubits, typically one or two at a time. So here in this case, we have, OK, so in this example, U1 acts on, is an element of U2. U2 is an element of U4. U3 is an element of U4. But notice that the underlying Hilbert space is different. So in this case, it's the Hilbert space of the first 2 qubits. And in the case of U3, it's the Hilbert space of the first and the last qubit. So then our quantum state at any given time is equal to a product of U5, U4, U3, U2, U1, acting on 0 tensor n, where this is just a product of unitaries. So notice that Whereas quantum mechanically, what happens first is on the right, and we move to the left. So U1 first, then U2, then U3. When we write out the circuit, the time order is reversed, right? So U1 is on the left, U2 is next. That's just what people do, so you have to get used to it. The other thing I want to mention is that what am I suppressing in this notation? Tensor products, right? So really what this means is, so U1, what that actually means in this is, let's put the first qubit on the left of our tensor product. So this is actually U1 tensor identity, U2 is equal to, so here there are n minus 1 of these. U2 is equal to U2 tensor identity. And how many identities are in this one? N minus 2, perfect. And then U, OK, I'm not doing U3. U4 is equal to identity cross U4. I should probably put a prime on here or something. Tensor identity, where here we have n minus 2. All right, so that's just implicit in this notation. But the value of the circuit is it's all clear where everything's acting. So that's why people write circuits out. It's kind of an easier way to illustrate things. All right, so this is our set of operations, and then the readout. And now I can make more precise some of these statements I was making with regards to that. The readout is a PVM consisting of a collection of projectors, where L is an element of 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. So because lots of computing scientists are involved in quantum computing, we all count from 0 instead of 1 as a typical convention. So this is a projective measurement as usual. So we have a set of orthogonal projectors and what they correspond to. So pi 0 is equal to the projector 0, 0, 0. It projects onto the all 0 bit string. Pi 1 projects onto 1, 0, 0, all the way up to pi 2 to the n minus 1, which is the bit string of all 1s. Yeah, so I could have just written this as L, right? So in other words, pi L is equal to LL, where L is an element of a bit strings of length n. This is equal to bit strings, bit. This is equal to the set of bit strings of length n. Sorry, this is a little bit, you guys obviously, I'm being too pedantic, I think, here. Set of bit strings of length n. Bit strings of length n. Set of n bit strings. Jeez. Okay, so how many different outcomes do we have? We have 2 to the n possible outcomes. So we run the quantum computer. We start out in the zero state. We program our gates. We get some effective unitary in U 2 to the n. Then we do a measurement. And then the final output information is a bit string. All right? So that was now it should be clear what I was talking about here. What you generally want to know is these complex numbers, Ci. That tells you about the quantum state, which is your state of knowledge. Okay? But what you actually get is just some bit string, which is a sample from this probability distribution. So if you want to estimate these quantities, Ci, you need to repeat the quantum computation many times and estimate the probabilities. And that can be hard. Yeah. It's a state of incomplete knowledge.
But, you know, it's not even a state of incomplete knowledge. You don't have the incomplete fact either.
You know, that's a very good question. You're really picking at the thread. You know, you're picking at a thread there. No, I mean, that's a very good question. No, it's great. It's great. But I mean, I can't. I'm sure there is a good answer to that, and I'm sure I should know it. I need a pithy response to that. Whose knowledge, right? That's the. It's your knowledge. The person that did these operations, any person that knows what operations were performed, their knowledge about the quantum computer is that the quantum state encodes their knowledge. The person who programmed that sequence of unitaries, that's who. No, I don't know the coefficients. It's this unknown probability distribution, right?
Yeah, but anybody who has this distribution is by definition not going to do it, right?
No.
A quantum, the state of the final bit state of a quantum computation should be deterministic in the sense that the final bit state of a classical computation is not the best way to figure it out is by doing the computation.
Yeah, okay. All right.
How is it a state of knowledge when we don't know it? It's in the computer, but not yet in your mind, because you have a computer.
So how come you're clever enough to know to ask that question, but not clever enough to know the answer? That's what I want to know. No, that's an excellent. That's a very deep question. Very deep. But let me just set it aside. Save it for Lucian or Rob. That's your next group meeting, which is later today. All right. Okay. Sorry, are there other questions that I thought I saw some hands up? No? All right, we run out of blackboard space. No good. Okay, so that's our quantum computation. So now let's talk about how do we define a set of elementary operations that can give us the ability to generate an arbitrary unitary on the full register. Okay, so there's some nice group theoretic issues there. So the question is universality. So you want a set of operations, elementary operations on one or two qubits at a time, which can generate an arbitrary unitary in the unitary group acting on the n qubits. Okay, so we want to realize any u in the unitary group. So the idea is we want the way to say this is we want a universal set of elementary gates. Okay, so now this is a solved problem, basically. So we know that there are many universal sets. Okay, so one universal set is the following. I allow arbitrary unitaries in U2, so arbitrary rotations of a single qubit on each qubit. And I allow a C naught between any pair of qubits. Okay, what's a C naught? So the C naught is an element of U4. And in particular, in the computational basis, the C0 has a matrix representation, which is 1, 1. So what you see is happening here is in our basis, we have our basis 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. If the first qubit is 0, we do the identity operation. If the first qubit is in the 1 state, we're going to flip the target qubit. So what this looks like is it's denoted like this. So this is the state of my first qubit, and this is the state of my second qubit. And then what happens is we can write phi as, oh, I can't lift up this board, so I shouldn't write here. Oh, Jesus. God, I was mic'd up there. OK. What do I want to write out? Right. So let phi equal alpha 0 plus beta 1. And then psi, will let it equal gamma 0 plus delta 1. And then the effect of the C0 acting on phi psi is that it's going to create the state alpha gamma 0, 0. So if the first qubit is 0, nothing happens. Alpha, delta, 0, 1. And then we're going to flip the second bit if the first bit is 1. So if we have beta, then we have beta gamma 1, 1 plus beta delta 1, 0. So notice that the coefficients, I swapped the terms there. So generally speaking, what the C0 does is if I have C, T, what the C0 does is it takes me to C, T plus C, where this is addition modulo 2. Here, C and T are just bits. So the point is, as long as we have, it turns out that just having almost any 2-qubit gate in U4 combined with all unitaries on individual qubits in U2 will give us universality. But the C0 is a conceptually simpler one. Yeah?
One thing, that notation with the O plus is the 0, 0, 0 plus, I mean, 0 plus 0 is 1.
Yeah, 0 plus 0 is 1, 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 1 is 0.
Okay. So
yeah, sorry, this is addition mod 2.
I think in the diagram it's also a little plus.
Oh, is it a plus here? Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you. That is supposed to be a plus. Right. Okay, so this is fine. But traditionally, in computation, you have a discrete set of gates. So what you really want is a discrete set. So this is a continuous set, because I'm allowing arbitrary rotations of a single qubit. So an arbitrary rotation of a single qubit will be parameterized by two angles, which are real numbers. And so it's hard to program that. So you want a discrete set of gates. So the goal is we want a universal discrete set. Finite. Okay, and so now we're ready. You guys say, well, that's impossible. And of course, it is impossible. But the idea is that we can find a finite set of gates which can get us epsilon close to any unitary with some small overhead. So a typical finite set would be the Hadamard on each qubit, the phase gate on each qubit, the pi over 8 on each qubit, notice that the pi over 8 has a pi over 4 in it, for historical reasons, and the C-naught between each pair. And then there's this result called the Solovay-Kitaev theorem. And the Solovay-Kitaev theorem says that using these gates, well, I mean, clearly what we all need is we need the single qubit gates to generate something arbitrarily close to any unitary in U2. And then with, once we add the C-naught, we get universality over U2 to the n. So the point is using only the, we can get epsilon close. So here's Solovay-Kitaev theorem. We can get epsilon close to any U in U2 using log C 1 over epsilon, 1 over epsilon gates from this set. Where C is of order 2, where C is approximately, C is a constant. So it's log, basically log squared of 1 over epsilon is the number of extra discrete gates you need to approximate any continuous gate in U2. So this is a very small overhead cost. But it's much more practical from the point of view of designing a computer to have a discrete set. And there's all kinds of interesting things you can learn now, which is if you drop the pi over 8 gate on each qubit, so you just have the Hadamard, the phase gate, and the C-naught. Then you generate, that's a not a universal set. What that set generates is something called the Clifford group, which has nothing to do with the Clifford algebra. It's just the same name, different concept. The Clifford group, also sometimes called the set of stabilizer operations, it's something that Dan Gottesman has pioneered. And the Clifford group is extremely interesting. First of all, it's central to error correction. People typically build the most successful error correcting codes and fault tolerant schemes are built on the Clifford group, which is not universal. It turns out that using only Clifford operations, any circuit using only Clifford operations can be simulated efficiently, which means you're not going to get any exponential speed up if you don't have the pi over 8. But what's interesting is that using only Clifford operations, so it's dropping this one, we can generate states of very high entanglement. We can create Bell pairs and all kinds of other interesting things just by applying the Hadamard and the C-naught. So if you take the state 0, 0, you apply Hadamard to the first qubit, and then you apply a C-naught where the first qubit is the control and the second qubit is a target, you get a Bell state. You get an entangled state of two qubits, a maximally entangled state of two qubits. So we have computations with large amount of entanglement, which can be simulated classically efficiently. And then just to advertise some of my own work, within the past couple of years, we constructed, if you think of qubits, which are D-level quantum systems for your quantum computing, we showed that circuits composed of Clifford gates on qubits, where the dit is odd prime, you can actually have a simple probabilistic classical model for that entire process. Basically, you think of it as a ball in a box that's just moving around, and you have highly entangled states and so on. Okay, so anyways, that's a natural point to wrap up. So Are there any questions about this last discussion or anything else for that matter? All of your answers, all of your questions have been answered?
No. I had one question from a little bit earlier. You said that, so you mentioned something about errors in your quantum computations coming from the uncertainty principle.
Errors? The indeterminism of the output is what I meant.
But so if you were to do a classical computation and you just happen to do it using qubits,
okay.
You should sort of always stay in eigenstates.
Yeah, you would at every point in time, you would be in an eigenstate of the computational basis. You would be in a computational basis state. So you would never have superposition.
So where does the uncertainty come in?
Well, remember, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle just tells you that it's not really the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, but really just, I mean, if you're in an eigenstate of the observable you're going to measure, which is the computational basis, then there's no uncertainty.
Okay.
So yes, the quantum mechanics contains a subset of cases in which you have no uncertainty because you happen to be measuring in an eigenstate of the state you're measuring is an eigenstate of your observable. But generically, that's not the case. So in almost all cases, where almost all is in the sense of, you know, measure one of quantum states, you will have some uncertainty about the outcome.
Okay. Good.
So I was talking about a typical case rather than a necessary case.
But that's still nothing to do with like computation relations, right?
Maybe, you know, calling it Heisenberg uncertainty principle was probably the wrong. What I meant to say is the fact that we have uncertainty.
Okay.
The fact that quantum states have uncertainty for typical measurements is what I meant to say.
Okay.
That's better, thanks. In fact, when I said that, I thought, okay, that was a bit. So that's good. Anything else? No? Okay, great. Well, thanks a lot. I have to say, I really enjoyed teaching this class. I thought that there were just a phenomenal number of excellent questions. And it was a lot of fun to see you guys so interested and participate so much. I really enjoyed it. So thanks.